Blog Talk Radio.
Hi everyone, this is Justine Rotolo. I'm also known as Miss ADD. I want to welcome everyone to the program today. Before I bring on our guest, Eric Trivers, I want to talk about, for those of you who live in the Los Angeles area, I run two adult support groups for CHAD, children and adults with ADD. The first group, which has been going on now close to 6 years, is in Torrance, California, located at 2785 Pacific Coast Highway, and it's Wednesday nights from 7:30 to 9. So if you're in the area, please come by. It's held at the Center for Learning Unlimited. It's a school dedicated to children and adolescents with ADHD and on the autistic spectrum. And then on Thursday nights, it's in Culver City. It's at the Share Building, 6666 Green Valley Circle. Thursday nights from 6 to 7:30. So if anybody's in the Los Angeles area and want to come by and join us, that would be great. So I want to tell you a little bit about Eric before I bring him on. He practices in Northern Illinois. He specializes in ADHD and high-functioning autism. As a psychotherapist, he works with children, teens, parents, and adults. And he's a national speaker, and he also has ADHD. So let's get Eric on the program. Hi, Eric.
Hello. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I am doing great, and I've had my last name botched for most of my life, so it is Eric Tivers.
Sorry,
Tivers. That's what usually is botched by
you know, I have ADHD. What can I tell you?
I totally get it. There is no harm done by botching.
I'm so sorry. Okay, it's Eric Tivers, and I think today we're going to talk about feeling productive with ADHD. That's correct?
Yes, that's one of the things that we'll probably be discussing. You know, it's funny because I also have my podcast ADHD Rewired, and I tell you, Justine, half the time when I'm about to introduce my guest, my mind just goes blank. I'm like, who am I talking to?
Yes, I know the feeling. I do. Hey, you know, Eric, can you tell?
Yeah.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was just gonna say that part of my brain that you know takes care of names. Doesn't take care of it so well.
No, and I'm the same way. It's very interesting. I have to like look at somebody and say their name and relate it to something so I'll remember the name.
And every once in a while I can remember someone's name, but it's I'm still trying to figure out what's going to work for me.
So listen, why don't you tell us a little bit about, even though I mentioned what you do, a little bit about your practice and what else you do before we go on to the topics.
Sure. Well, thanks for having me on.
You're welcome. Excited.
So about 2 hours ago, I was at the beach. So,
nice.
I'm coming into the office just to chat with you today. So
great.
What I do, I'm in private practice, as you said. I specialize in ADHD and high-functioning autism.
Okay.
So I kind of fell into working with autism about 10 years ago. I was working at a therapeutic day school after I finished my bachelor's in social work. The school started an autism program. And what that meant was they brought in these two kids that were from out of state who were in state hospitals because their behaviors were so significant. They needed that 24-hour care. So I didn't know anything about autism. And I got thrown into this classroom because I'm a male and I was trained in how to do physical restraint to help these kids be safe. And
okay.
My first day working with autism, I was dealing with an 8-hour long tantrum with two kids.
God. Okay.
And I loved it. And the reason I loved it, because I mean, it was hard, it was challenging, but I know that these kids were not like, they weren't like being bad because they were bad
right.
kids. They were so dysregulated and so I was just so intrigued, like what's going on in these kids' brains. And as I got to really understand and work with them more, I was realizing, you know, there's a lot of similarities between autism and ADHD.
Yeah.
So, fast forwarding a bunch of years, I went to grad school. I worked at a couple of different places. I ran a group home. I worked in a behavioral clinic, and then I started my own practice. And in my own practice, I focused on, I was thinking about who are my kind of ideal clients. And those are kind of people who are very similar to me, who have ADHD, and also those with really high functioning autism, what some people still call Asperger's, but we're now calling everything autism. So that's kind of who I work with. What I do is I help people increase their self-awareness so they know how they learn, how they operate, and what's going to work for them. Mm-hmm. Helping people get that sense of self-acceptance. And, you know, acceptance doesn't mean, I accept all my, everything I have a hard time with, and I just accept it, and I throw my hands up in the air and say, oh, I have a hard time with this, so I can't do it. No, acceptance means you actually really understand the nature of your challenges, as well as understand your strength, and you know what you have to do to use them.
Right. That's great. It's awesome. Yeah. Self-awareness is big. It's very big in my practice as well. Because I believe that self-awareness is the first step in getting better.
I would agree with that. I would absolutely agree with that. Because then adding to that the self-advocacy skills and self-determination. And that was actually what I started using in grad school. That was my graduate research thesis was working with students with disabilities who had no awareness. I was working with this eighth grade group, and my whole premise was helping increase kids' understanding of kind of how they learn. Because I went into this group and I did a baseline survey with these kids, and this eighth grade kind of mixed cross-categorical special ed classroom. This was in Chicago Public Schools. And so I asked them, do you know, and I just said it really vaguely, do you know why you were in this class? I didn't even call it special ed. I didn't say, do you know why you have an IEP? I said, do you know why you were in this class? And do you know what the most common answer was from these kids?
No.
I'm retarded.
They didn't know. Oh, God.
And they believed that.
Oh, God.
And then I asked them, do you guys know what's in your IEP? And the crickets, what's an IEP?
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. So over this 8-week period with these kids, we talked through the whole process of what it means to learn differently. I gave examples of celebrities and well-known people who have different learning challenges, dyslexia, learning disabilities, ADHD. I did some kind of role playing where, because I told kids that most kids would rather look bad in front of their friends than look dumb. And I said, and here's how this works, and here's why self-awareness and self-advocacy skills are so important. So let's say you really struggle to read, and the teacher calls on you, and you hate reading in front of others. So what are you going to do? Sit there and stutter and mumble and struggle to read in front of your peers? No. So what I did is, maybe you guys have done something like this or seen something like this. Took the book, called the teacher stupid, threw the desk over, and walked out of the classroom. Then I came back in, and they got it. They were like, yeah, we get it. And so we went through and helped them understand that we all have these different learning styles. And yes, some things are going to be challenging. And why we have an IEP, what does it mean? And I, by the end of this group, I was able to teach these kids who had no idea, they just thought they were retarded, which is couldn't be further from the truth or, more derogatory. And I taught these kids how to actually run their IEP meeting for their freshman year of high school.
Wow. Awesome. That's so amazing. Tell me something. For people who are listening too that have kids that are, high functioning autistic, how do you develop self-awareness in those children? What do you do?
Great, great questions. One of my actually very favorite things that I do, and I get called by a lot of families and do this, is I will work with the entire family in explaining the diagnosis.
Right.
And so what I do is I begin by, I do a whole kind of family inventory, and this is like a several session process. And we create these on a big whiteboard or some of these big like butcher blocks, sticky note pages. And we start with strengths, because we know that individuals with high functioning autism often have some pretty significant strengths.
Yes.
And that's what's, to me, that's one of the most interesting aspects of working with individuals with high functioning autism, is that most of these clients that I have with high functioning autism are way smarter than I am. I mean, they will do things that blow my mind. I mean, it's, yet they struggle so much socially and emotionally,
right.
And you know, often have very rigid behaviors, but some of their intellectual abilities are just amazing to me. It's just jaw dropping.
Yeah.
And so we go through and we talk about strengths, and then we talk about interests, then we talk about quirks, and then we talk about challenges. And so we have everyone in the family kind of going through this. And then what I do is we talk about how we give names to things and how scientists categorize things. I'll use the example, you know, if we're talking about an animal, and it's an animal that has a pet, that we have as a pet, and it's furry, and it has four legs, and we're starting to narrow it down, and it barks, now we know we're talking about a dog.
Mm-hmm.
So when it comes to human behavior, it's kind of similar. So, because everyone has, you know, quirks, everyone's unique in their own way, everyone has different interests, but sometimes when people have a whole category of things that are kind of different from most people, scientists will give descriptions to those kinds of people that help us understand those kinds of people, which then helps those people kind of understand the world more.
Right.
So, you know, and if I try to tap into their special interests, or if they're interested in dinosaurs, we'll do it. Categories of dinosaurs, if it's computers, we'll do that. You know, so it's really tapping into what are they interested in to create that analogy so they can understand the categorization. And then usually once we get to the very end of that, I will say to them, you know, congratulations, you have something called autism. And I, you know, share with them, and I make it as a congratulations. And
yes,
it's really funny. I had one and usually the parents are the ones that are really freaked out. And
I know.
Like, oh, what are they going to say? What are they going to say? You know, and it's like all the clients I've done this with, except for one, and I'll share the story in a second. It was just a very matter of fact, like, and then the next question was, what's for dinner? You know, where like their parents are expecting this like watershed moment. And it's like, no, this is just factual stuff for them. It's like, you know, they'll process it. But when we used to call it, so here's the story. So when we used to call it Asperger syndrome,
right?
I had a client who was about 10 or 11 years old, and he was in a therapeutic day school. And this was the first client I had that got actually quite upset when I told him that he had an Asperger syndrome. And then the following week, you know, they came back and the dad said, I'm going to tell you why he was upset. He heard Asperger syndrome and all he heard was syndrome. And he thought of Down syndrome because he has a kid in his class who has Down syndrome. And so, which is such a typical, I someone with autism to do is to latch onto a specific detail and miss the bigger picture.
Yeah.
So, but it's really, you know, self-awareness is, you know, for me, I didn't know that I had ADHD until I was in college. I almost failed out of college my freshman year.
Wow.
I got my first semester, I got a 2.2. My second semester, I decided I should open up books. And then I got a 1.8.
That's great.
Right. So, and my parents told me they were going to pull me out if I didn't get higher grades than a 2.2. And I, you know, being one of the traits of some people with ADHD is they can be very convincing.
Yes.
Parents may call it argumentative. I call it convincing. but you know, I'm so fortunate that I got this second chance because I happened to have this dinner date with a friend, and this is somebody who changed my life. And Justine, I don't remember who this person was. All I know, it was a girl that I had this dinner with, and I think it was at an Italian restaurant. Those details are very fuzzy. But I remember her telling me that over the summer that she was diagnosed with ADHD, and she was describing all these things to me, and she was describing how it was for her when she would read. And that was like, oh. And it was like for the first time someone was describing me. And I went that week and got an evaluation.
Wow.
And I, you know, so I passed the test, I guess you can say, so I met the criteria for ADHD. And I wasn't hyperactive. I had an inattentive presentation.
Oh, okay.
So that's why it was missed. I was
yeah.
Spacey.
They fly under the radar. Yeah.
That's right. So I got a diagnosis. I started taking Adderall, and I can tell you, I felt normal for the very first time in my life.
Yeah.
And
it's an amazing feeling.
Oh my! And Jesse, there was a there's a story that I like to tell about that. I went to Bradley University, and I was in a fraternity, which when I think back to it, I'm like, wow, I was in a fraternity. That was so not even me. But so I lived in a fraternity house, but I was in my room, and I'm reading a book from one of my sociology classes. It was a book called Crested Kimono. It was the comparative Japanese family system. And I think the only reason that detail is relevant is because I remember it, right? So I got through the end of the first chapter of the first time being on Adderall. And I remember sitting wow. there in my brown, like squeaky chair that I got at Goodwill. I looked at wow. the end of the chapter. I closed the book and I started crying.
Yeah.
Because I retained everything I read. I understood what I read. And even when I'm telling this now, I get choked up because it's like,
yeah.
I struggled so, so much in yeah. school. And it's like, if I would have known, if the teachers would have known, if my parents would have known.
Yep.
And, you know, because I always wanted to do well, which is why this feeling of, you know, shame when I was called lazy and and so I look at lazy as a four-letter word. I'm like, don't ever call a kid lazy.
No, no, no. I tell people, I know that word.
I know our friend Tom Nardone likes to wave the lazy flag, he's not lazy.
And
either.
I tell him, no, it's not lazy. It's overwhelmed, Tom. There's a big difference. Yeah. It looks very similar, but I don't believe. I tell my parents that I haven't practiced. There's no such thing as lazy, and it's a label. Let's not go there, because I was called lazy, stupid, and a procrastinator. So.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep. And you know, I look at lazy as what I was doing about 2.5 hours ago. I was sitting on the beach with my son, burying him in sand, not really doing much of anything. That's lazy. That's the choice of an activity.
Well, of course, yeah. Thinking but that's different than not getting work done. Do,
right. Thinking yeah. of all the things you have to do and not doing them. That's executive right. dysfunction.
Right. Exactly. It's initiation. It's not being able to get up and move around and also feeling overwhelmed because there's too much in your brain.
Yes,
no, I get it.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes. So, all right. So I got this diagnosis. I got the medication. I changed majors from communications, which I did horrible in. I'm a horrible writer. And anyone that works with me as far as with my writing know how bad of a writer I am. I make typos constantly. Every once in a while, because I have a rule that whenever I send out an email from my email list, that I have to have my wife or somebody else look at it.
Yeah.
Every once in a while, it looks good. I've triple checked it. I wake up in the morning and my wife will say, I got your email. You know that Tuesday is the 7th, not the 8th, right? I'm like, oh, no.
Yeah, I get it. Yes, I can relate.
So I switched my major to social work. And from that, my first semester on Adderall, I got a 3.75, and I never got below a 3.5 from that point on.
Wow. Amazing.
So my tools were Adderall and determination.
Okay.
Which could only take you so far. I mean, I worked my butt off. Some people pull all nighters. I actually pulled an all weeker once.
You didn't sleep?
For a week.
Oh my God.
The hallucinations that occurred at the end of that week were, I mean, I just worked so hard and I didn't have the study skills. I just had the work ethic, you know?
Yeah.
I spent hours and hours and hours and hours in the library. So wow. I didn't know how to work efficiently. You know, I read everything. Yeah. But in this process, I also, you know, a couple of things that I learned is that I have to enjoy what I'm doing.
Yes.
If I don't enjoy what I'm learning, it's like I can't. It's so hard.
It's the same with most people. I mean, with ADHD, the kids that I see, they tell me how boring and mundane school is, and it was for me. I mean, yeah, unless it was something that I was very interested in or the kids are interested in. You're right. We don't do boring well at all.
But I do interesting really well.
Yes. Yes.
You know, I look at, I know. At like boring. So I have a word that I think I came up with, but I'm not 100% sure. Have you ever had those things where you, like an idea that you think you thought of, but like in the back of your mind, you sort of wonder, but I'm going to claim it. But if somebody else says no, like I came up with that first, I feel free to correct me. So the word is importance.
Okay.
It's stuff that's important, but boring.
Right. Yeah.
And that's,
yeah.
You know, the filing, the, you know, the phone calls, the stuff that we just like don't like to do, but we have to.
Right.
So, all right, let me kind of fast forward a little bit. So I went back to grad school after working for a couple of years. And so halfway through grad school, here's a side story of grad school. And this was sort of a pivotal moment in the side story. So I'm driving to grad school. I went to University of Illinois at Chicago, and I was living with my parents at the time.
Okay.
And, you know, I had a couple of early morning classes. And I'm driving down on Route 94, which is the highway that goes towards Chicago. And I got rear-ended on the way down. And then I rear-ended the person in front of me. My car was totaled.
No.
As a sort of funny side note, though, the person I rear-ended turned out to be, what I would learn later, my mother-in-law. Because when I met my wife, my now mother-in-law says to my wife, Sarah, goes, why do I know that name? Tivers.
That is the funniest story. I thought you were going to tell me you met your wife because you rear-ended her, but you met her separate of this.
Yes, I met her separate from that. But
oh
one
my
of the
God.
Things, what, I mean, so the accident wasn't my fault, however... Like I was definitely overtired and driving, you know, doing the kind of bobbing and weaving while you're like really tired, trying to stay awake, going to school. And so what I realized was I was reading everything that you had to read.
Okay.
But nobody actually told me that you can't actually do that in grad school. That's not actually expected of you. Cause what that means is you're reading 500 pages a week of clinical text.
Yeah.
And I did it for a semester.
Oh my God.
And that was on top of, you know, of all my internship and everything else. So I started, this is when I really started figuring out how to crack the code for productivity. Because I had to. I was like, okay, working hard got me this far. But I'm killing myself here. Like I'm not sleeping. I'm doing crazy stuff. And I sort of have these perfectionistic tendencies, and part of that sort of came from, oh, I'm not dumb, I can be successful. And which is this very interesting thing is that now, you know, after I had that first experience of my 375 back in my sophomore year of college, that's when I started getting anxiety, because I now that I knew that I could do it,
right,
that bar got raised so high that it's like, I know I could do it, but sort of, kind of, because I'm kind of inconsistent and I can really do it well sometimes, you know? So I was completely, in college, I look back at it and I'm kind of embarrassed. I never showed up to class on time. I was 5 minutes late to every single class I ever went to. And I didn't think it was that big of a deal. It was just like, oh, it's just Eric. He comes to class.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
And I look back at that, and that must have been so disrespectful to my teachers. And not just disrespectful, but interrupt. Like it was an interruption. You know what I mean?
Yes.
And I look back at that now, and I just, you know, it was, I loved college because it wasn't like you were in trouble if you came in late. Right? It's not like you got a detention if you came in late.
Right. Right.
But I look back and wow, they must have thought I was a real pain in the butt. So, and also in college, every single semester, every semester without fail, all 10 semesters, it took me 5 years to graduate, at least one time during the first week of each semester, I found myself sitting in the wrong class. Because I either was on the wrong day, single semester for five years I did that at least one time.
That's very funny. What am I doing in German? What?
Right.
I didn't take German.
It's like, what are they talking about? Although I did have one class that I ended up staying in and then switching my class. It was really interesting.
That's great. Oh, that's great.
And that was also when I learned one of the tricks to getting good grades, and that was to not care about grades. It was to care mm-hmm. about learning.
Yep.
And so yeah. one of the things that I did too is I negotiated almost all of my assignments with my professors. So they would give a paper. I was like, you know, let me see if I could spin this towards my interest. And I never had a professor say no. And that was
excellent.
That was so critical for me.
Yeah, that's excellent.
So let's talk productivity strategies. I don't know where you want to where you want to dive in.
No, this is good. I mean, I know that this is a big issue for people with ADHD, productivity. So yeah, let's go there.
Okay. So I guess before we go there, because you know I do a lot of talks on productivity, but I've also been blending. Are you familiar with Brené Brown?
Yes.
Okay. So for your listeners, Brené Brown, she talks about shame and vulnerability, and I think it's a must listen to for I think anyone who has a pulse, because I think it's so important. It's such a validating piece of work what she talks about.
Yeah.
And one of the things that she said in one of her in her books and one of her talks that she gave is that we need as a culture to stop looking at exhaustion as a status symbol and productivity as self-worth. And when I remember I was listening to this on audiobook, and I was going for a walk one afternoon as a kind of a break during my day, and I heard her say that, and I stopped in my tracks. And can I swear on your show, or is it a?
Yes, you can swear.
Okay, so it was I stopped. I'm like, oh shit, when she said the idea of we have to stop having productivity equated to self-worth.
Yes.
Because it hit the nail right on the head. And I was like, oh man, I totally equate productivity to self-worth.
Yes.
And so it's given me a really important kind of paradigm shift in the last 6 months, I think, since I started really digging into her stuff. I mean, I'm completely obsessed with her.
yes.
You know, because it's her stuff is brilliant, and it cuts right to the heart of the struggles that we have. It's like we try so hard, and so it's that idea of we are enough no matter what we're doing. And
that's exactly right.
And Justine, I tell myself that, but if I'm really honest, I don't always believe that. And it's a battle.
It's difficult to let go of that. I know. Yeah. It is.
You know, on my podcast, I had an episode called ADHD at 55 miles an hour, which is probably one of the most talked about episodes of my podcast. So I was doing, it was the second launch of one of my productivity groups. And I was trying to do like the knock it out of the park kind of online product launch or certainly, you know, online launch.
Okay.
And so I was doing, one of these, I was at my office until 2 a.m. every day creating content, like doing this, like, I mean, doing these online launches. This is Jeff Walker style launch. I'm not sure if you're familiar with this stuff.
No.
This stuff works great, but it's just a ton of work.
Right.
So I'm doing this, and I had a talk that I was going to be giving on this on Thursday to a group of about 100 parents at the school district. And I knew at the time when I agreed to this talk that I was going to be in launch week, but I agreed to it anyways. So one of the rules I've had for myself is do not go give a talk when you have not had a full night of sleep the night before. Because usually what I end up doing is I will start a sentence and they'll forget what I was saying. Like I've given talks where I've been a complete just bubbling idiot. And I really have been working on getting better talks. I'm involved in Toastmasters. I'm really crafting that skill because I enjoy it.
Yeah.
Luckily, I was giving a talk that I've given probably about 10 times. So this was not the first time I've given this talk. So it was Thursday. I have so far had, I think, about 49 episodes out of the podcast, and I have not missed a week. And I felt so awesome about the fact that I had not missed a week. I've been so consistent. Thursday of my launch week, I still had I only had 6 people in the group. I needed 6 more to sell it out. The registration was closing the following day. I had no podcast episode. So I took my digital recorder in the car and I recorded my episode driving to and from this school presentation that I was giving.
That's really cool.
And it was a total stream of consciousness. I had someone tell me that it was like an audio MRI of ADHD.
That's great.
I was sharing my fears. I was sharing my self-doubts. I was sharing that there was a cop behind me. I was sharing that I thought I made a wrong turn. I was sharing when my GPS was interrupting me and I had to pay attention for a moment. Every distracting thought, I shared it. And
that's great.
And I shared this on my show a few times. I had an email from a listener who thanked me because I was really actually nervous to release this episode because I was being very vulnerable. I was not at my best.
When people love it. They love that.
Right. I had someone email me and tell me that they said, thank you for releasing that because they were starting to wonder if I actually had ADHD because I seemed so together.
Right, right. Yeah.
And I still got, even now, I still get like goosebumps and choked up when I say that out loud because it's, you know, I work really hard to seem like I'm together. I have a placard at home that my father-in-law gave my wife and I. And this placard says, masquerading as normal day after day is exhausting.
I love that. That's great.
And it is, you know, and I try hard. And so I don't always have it together. And I often have phone calls that I haven't returned. I think about returning them for days. And then it's this huge task because I should have called yesterday. So, you know, I have lots of stuff like that. I have things that I forget to do, you know, so I have those ADHD moments. So let's, you know, some of the things that, you know, as far as some of the basics that I've learned is that I have no concept of time. I am completely time blind.
Okay.
I have gotten better, but naturally I am completely time blind. So in my office, in any spot in my office, no matter where I am sitting, I have at least 1 clock and 1 timer.
Oh, great.
Okay.
So that's really good.
So I equate to leaving the house without a watch as to leaving the house without clothing on. I mean, I went back on the rare occasion I forgot my watch at home. I've had to turn around to go get it because I'm like, I can't. Like, I either have to go to the store and buy a new watch because I can't be without a watch because I'm time blind.
Okay.
So I used to lie to myself all the time. And I think that a lot of probably your listeners, a lot of my listeners, we have the same lies. And I still catch myself in some of these lies. So the top lie I typically tell myself is, I'll remember that.
Yeah.
And whenever I catch myself saying that, it's my red flag to stop.
Yes.
No way.
Yes.
It doesn't matter that I'm going to do something in 1 minute. And one of the things it's, you know, part of that's the working memory. But even if I would remember it, why strain my brain? When we hold information in our brain, we are taxing our executive functions. When we tax our executive functions, we're going to have less executive functioning resources available to do the more important stuff, the decision-making, the creativity, the problem-solving.
Right.
Why am I going to have to keep something in my mind for a few minutes when I could write it down?
Yes. There's a freedom in writing things down.
Yes.
That's what I tell people.
Another lie I would tell myself and believe is, this will just be 5 minutes.
Yeah, that's my favorite.
Uh-huh.
Yeah,
I'm going to just check my email. I have plenty of time.
Yeah.
I'll do it later.
Yeah. I can go to the store before I go to my appointment. Yeah.
Well, it's funny. Yeah. Actually, we're going to the store because I hate going shopping. Like, I go into a kind of sort of sensory overload because my brain doesn't filter visual information real well. I input everything and then I'm exhausted. So when I do have to go to the store, like when I see people who can like go to the store for one thing, get in and out in 5 minutes, I'm like, how do you do that? I can't. And I've done it a couple times. I'm like, wow, if I can just like put that in a bottle and, you know, and use that every time I need to go to the store.
Yeah.
I will go to the store for one thing and I will leave an hour later. And usually I will get the thing that I went for, but I'm so addicted. I'm looking at everything and I'm like, oh, well, while I'm here, it's like, and then I'm like comparing products and then I leave annoyed and frustrated and then I don't want to talk to anybody. And so what I'll actually do, because, you know, I'll know how long it will take to actually go to the store for like a quote unquote normal person. And then I'll add about 10 minutes, you know, so I give myself that buffer. And I will actually schedule going to the store before a client appointment because I know I have to get in and out.
That's a good idea.
I have that accountability piece of I have somebody that's going to be waiting for me. I don't have the luxury to browse.
Right.
I've actually, I've probably not the smartest thing I've done. I've gone to the store to run in and out and purposely left my keys in the car with engine running. Because I knew that there was a chance that it could get stolen.
You're lucky you didn't come out and the car was gone.
Well, yeah, I mean, that was like, I was using the adrenaline. I'm of like, okay, this is really not the smartest thing that I've ever done before. But it was like a convenient mart, so like I could see my car.
Oh,
but
okay.
It was like, you know, but it was still, it was like, this isn't smart. I better hurry. So
that's pretty funny. That's very funny.
I used to say a few years ago, you know, what's really interesting is as my productivity kind of insights have evolved, is what I've realized is that they keep evolving. So a couple of years ago, I had this like aha moment. I was in my backyard doing some gardening and I was doing some deep watering. So I just like changed the water like where the hose was. And like I had to keep like multiple timers going. And then like I had this like, what I guess I thought was a brilliant like aha, is that all like ADHD strategies come down to using timers and having reminders.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so I kind of went on that for about 2 years. So, but then I realized I actually didn't have the whole picture because I realized I was missing some pieces. So the other piece was you have to capture everything. So we're talking about, I'll remember that. Like, no, I won't. So it's capturing it. So if I set a timer, I have to write down, what is a timer for? Right? If I'm adding something to my calendar, I have to add every single detail. I assume that I will have amnesia.
Okay.
I will assume that I'm going to forget every single thing about this.
Right.
So when it comes time for that appointment, that thing, I have every single detail that I need. So I capture everything.
That's okay? Great.
And then
so
I
write it down.
Yes, I write it down.
Okay.
I used to say that I thought that like the iPhone with Siri and location-based reminders was the best thing to happen to ADHD since Ritalin.
Right.
And, you know, for me, it was for like a year or two. And then, you know,
what I discovered is
that the tools don't matter.
Right.
The functions of what we need matter. So we need something to capture information. We need something to keep us on track as far as timing. We need something to cue us, so the alarms, the reminders, right?
Yep.
So those are like the three main pieces. Then there's the fourth piece, and this is the piece that I hate. this is the important stuff, and this is the part called processing.
Right.
So I used to capture everything. I captured the idea. I captured the phone call I needed to return. I captured the thing I was going to do later. I captured. My inbox was so big that I didn't want to do anything. And I said, okay, I'll do it every Friday. And then it got so big, I'll do it. I wasn't in the mood that Friday, or I was having an ADHD kind of day, so I had to wait till next Friday. So here's the thing. I can do the capturing. I can do the timers. I can do the reminders. The processing is the glue that holds it all together. It's the stuff that's never going to be fun. This is where, if you want to be productive, you got to focus on the processing.
Right.
So it's in my productivity groups, I do what's called adult study hall. And what adult study hall is, it's the time to do the processing. It's to do all that stuff that we never, ever, ever want to do, like going through our inbox, replying to those emails, filing, right, making files, you right, know, those just tedious things. So what we do is we all meet on this virtual, it's a video conference platform. We say what we're going to, we say what we're going to work on. And we all mute our microphones. We keep the video cameras going and we get to work.
Great. That's awesome.
It's amazingly powerful.
Yeah. And they're doing the mundane stuff too, that they really don't want to do.
Or it's, some people in my current group who will, they've done with it, those projects that are really important.
Yeah.
They're having a hard time getting started on it. You know,
yes.
I always say the starting is the hardest part, that initiation. So sometimes
yes,
starting is one of the things we do in that. And I tell my group too that part of this adult study hall is completely selfish, because I would never do my own inbox if it wasn't for it.
That's a good thing you put together. That's awesome.
Yeah. So, and I have so I have this idea of, we got to take a trip, right? Think of the word trip.
Okay.
So it's timers,
okay,
reminders.
Okay.
Input, which is the capturing, so input, and then processing.
Great.
So we got to take a trip.
That's really
if we
great,
don't do all four of those parts, we're gonna have problems.
Right.
You know, so I just say, identify the boring but important stuff. Just call it what it is. Make it as shiny as you can. Make it as interesting as you can. It's tough to make that stuff interesting, though.
Yeah,
you know,
it is.
Like people would ask me, it's like, what's the best app for ADHD? Well, it's the one that you use. You know, I've given so many presentations on like technology and apps. I use a paper productivity notebook.
Yeah. Yeah, I write stuff down all the time.
And I use Evernote a lot. Do you use Evernote?
Yes, I do use Evernote. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I love one of the things I love about Evernote and how you can like tag things in Evernote is that it's like the most ADHD friendly filing system, because you can have it filed like everywhere.
Yeah.
So it's like
you I really do like that.
You can get something from like, say your doctor, and it's like, okay, do I file it under doctor? Do I file it under the doctor's name? Do I file it under the nature of the problem? The answer
right.
Is, yeah, sure.
Because then you forget where you filed it.
Right. And so you can, you know, you do a hashtag doctor, hashtag the doctor's name, hashtag like, you know, whatever the issue is. And it's all there. And you can search Evernote for all the words. And my favorite part of Evernote on the premium version is the Evernote document camera. And what I love about this, you can take a picture of a written note. And my handwriting, most second graders have better handwriting than I do. Evernote can read my handwriting. And I can go into Evernote and do a search, and I can actually find my stuff that I wrote down.
That's awesome.
It is awesome.
I hope everybody that's listening is going to start doing this, because that's really awesome. Yeah.
Another quick kind of productivity hack with Evernote. Evernote gives you an email account. Okay. So one of the things that you can do is, if you get an email that you really need to save, so say it's maybe you're going on a trip, and you get the reservation kind of confirmation. They're like, oh, where do I keep that? I don't want to keep it in my inbox, because it's going to get to, like, you know, I get 10,000 emails that I haven't read in my inbox. I'll never find it. So
right,
you can forward it to your email account. In the subject line, you can put, if you start it with an at symbol, and then a name of a notebook that you've already set up in Evernote, it'll go right to that notebook.
Oh,
and then
how cool
is that? You can add a hashtag following the at kind of your notebook name, and then you can tag it, and then it immediately becomes tagged in Evernote when you forwarded that email.
Oh, that's really cool. That's
Which
great.
Is awesome.
Yeah, that really is, because we lose a lot of different things that we're looking for. Yeah. No, that's great. So I hope a lot of people are listening and, you know, can use this. This would be very helpful.
Yeah, it's funny, because I was one of those people who, you know, didn't really like Evernote at first, and kept hearing, oh, Evernote's great, Evernote's great. It's like, yeah, I tried it, I don't get it, I don't like it. It seems boring. It's not shiny. It's, you know, and then I was hearing, I follow some productivity people, and I heard them talking about it. And one of the things that they were saying is like, they first got into it and they didn't like it and they kind of went away from it. And then they got back into it and now they love it. I'm like, oh, I tried it and didn't like it. Maybe I should go try it again. And I'm so glad that I did. Because I think one of the things Evernote is people don't understand, well, what do you use it for? Right?
Right.
It's basically a digital file cabinet. That's what you use it for. Right. It's a way to archive and capture everything. You can do web clips. You can do videos. You can even capture photos. You can forward emails. You can use it as like a to-do list. I don't really use it that way, but it can be as basic as like a notepad or as complex as you forward stuff to it. I love Evernote.
So it's great because you can make it as simple or complex as you choose to make it.
Yes, yes.
And I think that's really what it's all about, you know, in terms of the individual and what they need.
Yeah.
So let me ask you something. One of the things in the write-up that I noticed is that you're talking about new apps and software and other tech devices. And I noticed I'm not one of those people that are very much into the tech devices. I'm into writing a lot. Like I have to write things down. And what I tell people all the time, I'm sure you'll agree with this, is don't put things on little pieces of paper because you're going to throw them out. Yeah.
Agreed.
So I have a book.
And so do I. And one of the things I tell people, if the little piece of paper is the only option,
right,
that now you have a task. That task is to take that little piece of paper and process it by putting it into your main system.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. You gotta definitely do something with it. You can't put it somewhere where it's going to disappear. I mean, I tell people this story. When I was years and years ago, I was a buyer in department stores. And I started out when I graduated from college with this company called W&J Sloan's. It was a really fine furniture store in New York. And I remember I wasn't making a lot of money, just graduated from college. And Gimbel's, which was right down the street from us, no longer in business at all, they offered me a job. I was in the rug department as assistant rug buyer. And so the woman called me and I wrote down all the information on a little piece of paper and I threw it out. And I couldn't remember the woman's name. And the next time I went to market, which happened to be in Chicago, because Chicago had a big rug market, I ran into the people from Gimbel's and they wouldn't even look at me. So
you ever go to a restaurant and you have a big order and you have a waiter that's not writing a single thing down and they get it all right? It's the coolest magic trick I ever. It's like, how do you do that?
I know.
Oh,
I know.
Gosh.
I know. I can't. I can never keep that stuff in my head.
When I was in high school as a camp counselor, and the first day of orientation, the director of this camp, and there were probably 80 or 90 counselors, and all the staff were all in like this big circle, and the director was in the middle, and he was going through and doing this name thing, and he had everyone say their name, and then one time, and then he told everyone to mix up so like you're in a different spot. After one time, he was able to go through and do everybody's name.
Whoa.
I was like, that's crazy.
Oh, my God. See, I can't. Yeah, there's no way.
I mean, I can be in a group of one person, and you can tell me your name, and I'm going to forget.
I'm absolutely the same way. That's my biggest problem with ADHD is names. I don't know why.
It's my biggest social liability. But you know what's so interesting? And I think that dopamine is a factor, because I'm going to tell you a funny story. So I recently got have you ever heard of an elliptigo?
No.
So it's like an elliptical, but it goes. It's a bike. So it's like everything. So there's no seat. So it's like the motion of the pedals of an elliptical, right?
Wow.
So I've been wanting one of these for several years. I've had some back issues, and I do a lot of bike riding, but I really wanted an elliptigo. My uncle has one. He loves it. So I was on a bike ride with my son, who's going to be four. He's on the back trailer, and I see this woman, and I see that she's on an elliptigo, and I haven't like seen one up close. So I just get this kind of impulse. I'm like, I'm going for it. So I cry. It's a red light, but there's no cars coming. So she stopped. So I pedal really fast. And so I go up to her like really excitedly. This is a stupid question. I'm like, is that an elliptical? I'm like, clearly it's an elliptical, but I had to start it somehow. She's like, yeah, do you like it? She's like, oh, I love it. And my next question was, can I try it?
What did you say?
I can't even believe I said, well, she said yes. So, so I was talking to her for about 30 seconds, and then she let me try her elliptigo. And meanwhile, my four-year-old son is now standing there with the stranger that I met for 30 seconds, going, daddy, daddy. And I'm going 100 feet up, so he can still see me. But you know, it's one of these things where... Where like the elliptigo is such a weird like head turning thing, you know, or it's like it's almost like a call. People want other people to also get them, so it's like you're excited to have other people, you know, be excited about it. So I went, I found where they sell them. It was like 45 minutes away. I drove there, did a 30 minute test ride, came back dripping. Oh my! It was an amazing workout, and I bought one.
Oh, is it really? Oh wow.
It was awesome. It was awesome. And Justin,
so this is something you use outside. This is a bike, a bike.
Yes.
I've never heard of it. Okay.
So this is all about like names, right? So normally I'm horrible with names. I remember, not only did I remember this person's name, but I remembered where she lived. And she told me that like, there's these like Facebook groups for like elliptigo like riders. So I was able to like contact her, and so I'm always puzzled by why is it sometimes I can actually remember somebody's name.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, I was excited. I got excited in that moment.
Yeah.
And I probably had dopamine running, and it's like, man, I got to figure out like ways to excite people. Maybe I need to like startle people so I get a funny response from them and then introduce myself.
That's probably a great idea. I should try that.
No, I wish I had, at conferences when people wear like name tags, which is great.
Oh.
But then I have the other problem of I don't have very good eyes. My vision isn't great. So I'm kind of squinting and I can't like.
I can definitely relate. Oh, that's so funny. Yeah. The whole name thing is.
Yeah.
Wild.
I mean, I've tried the, you know, I've really tried. I've done the associations. I've tried writing things down. I've actually tried creating little stories and writing stories within like someone's name. It doesn't stick in my brain. It's really frustrating. It really is. It's
very frustrating.
Know
you know
how
what
important
I was just,
it is.
You know what I was just thinking about though too? You know, our brains are very quick. So like when I run these two support groups and when new people come in, I'm so excited to meet new people. I'm so excited that they're there and they want to help themselves and, you know, all these things that I just realized this. I'm so excited that they'll tell me their name and I'm more interested in finding out about them and why they're there and when would they diagnose.
Every detail that if someone told me what happened and like, you know, if we had a meal together, like everything I'll remember except for their name.
I know, and I have to tell you that a lot of people do get upset when you don't when you don't remember their name.
Right, and one of the things that I've learned to do, and I feel so it's lucky that you know I work in the field of ADHD, so people are a little bit more forgiving. But
yes.
You know, I usually say right away, like, hi, I'm Eric. You know, what's your name? And they tell me their name. And I say, I just want to tell you, I'm probably going to ask your name possibly somewhere between 30 to 40 more times. I'm so sorry, like. I just have a horrible, horrible time remembering names. That part of my brain that's just remember names, I don't think I have one of those. So forgive me. Please. I'll remember everything we've talked about, but I'm going to ask your name many, many, many times. So it's like I've had people, like when they see them like again and again, they'll tell me their name again. And I so appreciate them. Thank you. Thank you so much.
I know. Because they're great. Because the people in our population are, they're wonderful. I mean, we all get each other and we all have different, you know, executive function deficits and they manifest themselves differently as well. So they understand. They really do. They get
it. Right. And so I think part of it is to I'm pretty open to people, and I think that that's kind of part of how do you get the kind of social forgiveness of forgetting people's names, because it is kind of a social liability, is that you have to kind of just own up to it, joke about it a little bit, but then kind of take that responsibility for it.
So let me ask you something about social things.
Sure.
Nice segue into it. So in the world of high functioning autism, I personally have a son. He's 24. He's okay. NLD, so he's the lower end of the spectrum. But still, he struggles with the social aspects. And I, you know, he's doing a lot better because I've done a lot of work and having other people work with him. But, you know, what do you do for kids, adolescents, in high-functioning autism and ADHD when they're struggling with how to initiate a conversation with somebody?
Great, great question. So I do a lot of work with the model of social thinking.
Okay.
And so social thinking is a program that was, it was more of a theory that was created by a speech and language pathologist. Her name is Michelle Garcia Winner. Okay. And the idea is it's, you know, kids that have social skill deficits don't necessarily need social skill training, right?
Right.
What they need is to help, because it's not a social skill deficit, it's actually a social cognition deficit. They don't understand the social.
Right. Right.
Right. So one of the first things we do with initiation is because one of the things that often people will try to do in teaching kids with autism is they teach them all these rules of social behavior. They do this,
right.
do this, do that. Which doesn't really work because everything is contextual. Like, you know, you don't give eye contact to say hello to someone if someone looks like they're crying.
Yeah.
You know, or if someone's like in an argument or, you know, it's like, so there's so many different nuances to teach. So we first teach that idea of we got to first think with our eyes and look at the other people and try to figure out what might they be thinking about.
Okay.
Then we have to think about, okay. What kind of, you know, so if I want to engage with them, what kind of thoughts do I want them to have about me? Then I have to think about, okay, what do I need to do so I can, and when I say what kind of thoughts do I want them to have about me, I kind of break it down in really, really simply, good thoughts or weird thoughts.
Okay.
Okay. So because we talk about behaviors in the terms of things that are expected, because especially with kids with autism, they always like to know what's expected, right? They don't like unexpected things. It's very anxious. So we explain that, you know, well, you know, most people are actually like that, especially in the social realm, is that there are certain behaviors that are just expected and things that are unexpected. And so we talk about behaviors in that realm. And when you do the unexpected, people are going to have uncomfortable, kind of weird thoughts about you. Then they're going to treat you maybe not so nicely. You're not going to have the response you're kind of looking for. And then you're going to feel kind of bad.
Yeah.
You know, and so part of the thing is I have to teach that sometimes when you're entering a social situation, you have to do what's called and this is a term from social thinking, the superficial social test. It's called doing the social fake.
Okay.
Right? So for some of these kids, it's really challenging because basically what they're hearing is you want me to lie? And I said, yes, I do. Because when you go to the store and the clerk asks you, how are you? First lie right there, because that clerk does not care at all how you are. And then we're supposed to say, good. We could be having the worst day ever, but we're still supposed to say, good.
Right.
And then we're supposed to reciprocate. We're say, how are you? We don't really actually care, but we still say, how are you? And they say, oh, good. And when someone is not doing well and they actually tell us that and it's like not a close friend, it's really uncomfortable and awkward.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. And so part of that is helping people, like these kids, understand that you have to first understand that there's a lot of these weird ways that we as social creatures do, you know, acknowledge each other in each other's space. So we have to first share our space with each other effectively.
Right.
So much communication happens and so much social thinking happens before we open our mouth and do anything.
Yeah.
Right.
That's very true.
Right. And so it's focusing a lot on body language, focusing a lot on, you know, I am more interested in tone of voice than the words that are coming out of that person's mouth.
Yeah.
Like, to me,
yeah.
I don't care about the word please. Because yeah. I've had lots of kids, can I have that please?
Right.
Like, you
right,
are
right,
a
right.
jerk.
Yes. Yeah.
Say,
no,
hey, can I have that?
Right.
That
it's not congruent.
Right.
Yeah.
Not right. You know, it's.
Yeah.
And I've learned a lot of different ways to teach kids how to do this. And one of the challenges is that with some of our kids with autism, they have some kind of unique interests, and they might be very different interests from other kids. And so part of that is they have to realize that it's okay to have these unique interests, but
yes.
you have to, part of that social memory as we get to know people is we have to remember what people are interested in and what they are not interested in. And if you know that someone is not interested in something and they know that they are not interested in it, then you can't bring those things up because you're going to bore them to death and they're going to walk away from you and ignore
right.
you. And, you know, so the tough thing is teaching kids that, you know, it's okay to have, you know, these sometimes sort of obscure special interests.
Yes.
But sometimes these are, you know, and saying it's, there are other kids that are interested in this, but they're hard to find.
Right. Yeah. And because
right,
these kids that are on the spectrum too, they get into something and it's like, it's everything they do. I mean, it's
yes.
they hyper-focus.
Yeah.
I mean, and so everybody's supposed to really hyper-focus the same way. And there's mm-hmm. a rigidity about them.
Yes.
That can be difficult to deal with too, especially in a social setting for other kids.
Yep. And that's the piece about teaching flexible thinking. There's a,
yeah.
In social thinking, there's a great program for kids that are like K-5 called Superflex. And Superflex is a superhero that's trying to save social town from the team of unthinkables. And these unthinkables get into kids' brains and make them do things that show others that they are not thinking about them. And some of the characters
wow.
are Rock Brain, makes them kind of get stuck on their ideas. They're not flexible thinkers. Another character is Glass Man, that makes people kind of shatter. They make people have a big response to a small problem. One-Sided Sid is another one. Mean Gene, what's another one? Energy Harry. Yeah, Energy Harry is, you know, our ADHD kids. Space Invader was funny once. So there's all these different characters that what it does is it personifies a behavior. So instead
right.
of saying, you know, telling a kid, you know, it's like lighten up or be more flexible, you know, it's like focusing, oh, it looks like rock brains in your brain. And that
right.
is a super flexible strategy.
It's really good.
To
it's like Inside
it.
Out.
Yeah. What's
naming,
Inside Out?
Inside Out is the movie from Disney where they've
oh,
named
I haven't
emotions.
Seen that yet.
Oh, you got to see it. You got to see it because you can work with your kids and you can be naming emotions with them. It's amazing. And
cool,
and
cool.
it's more for adults even than it is. You'll cry, I promise you. But you have to see it. It's really great. Yeah.
No, and that's, so yeah, I've been working with kids with autism for about 10 years now. I started working with kids with more low functioning autism, you know, more severe needs. And so I now have a kid who's going to be 4 years old, and he has autism. So it is
wow.
a, you know, sometimes the world is just an interesting place. But he, you know, he's very high functioning, and you're talking about
wow.
special interests. He like him with numbers. I mean, it's
yeah.
so interesting because he has really a lot of areas of giftedness. I mean, he can fully read.
Wow.
And he's been doing that for a while, and he's not even four yet. But he'll be, like, talking to the kids in the neighborhood about, like, their addresses and all these numbers, and they're just like, what are you talking about? You know, they're just kind of looking at him. They're like...
That's so cute.
And, you know, it is, and it's like... And that's the thing, like, these... For young kids, it's like, what's cute now is going to be really annoying really
I know.
Soon. You know, and it's tough because it's like you want to, so it's helping find that balance between embracing their interests, but also
yeah.
helping them be flexible and helping them know that you got to figure out what other kids are sort of interested in. You know, that's why some kids I work with occasionally on the autism spectrum have a high interest in sports. And I always think these kids do so much better socially because as a culture, we're okay with knowing every statistic and every detail about
yes,
a sports team.
I know.
Like that's a, like for boys anyways, you know,
yep.
it's like we think about ritualistic behavior, right? Which is part of autism. Things have to be done the same way all the time, even if it's not functional. Think about the football season. I mean, I'm not into sports, so it's like you compare it to like, well, the guy who won't like wash the jersey all season long because it's like that
yes,
much.
Yes.
Why is it that that's okay?
Well, your son is lucky to have you as his dad because
you understand. I think it's also helped me very, very much as a clinician. And I'm going to tell you, it's much harder as a dad than it is as a clinician. On a daily basis, Justine, I will catch myself doing things that I know that if I were the therapist, I would be telling that dad.
I know. I have one. They both have ADHD, but you know, the younger one has NLD.
Today, I'm gonna share a story. So, one of the things that I always tell parents, as in my role of therapist when I'm giving presentations, is don't ask your kid why did you do that, because usually the honest answer is I don't know, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right. And that's where kind of lying gets in, because when his parents will say, well, I don't know, is in an answer. So we're at the beach and we're leaving and we're walking up towards like the stairs or some sand. And there's this woman, a little bit of a larger woman, who's laying on her towel on the beach. And my son just like runs up and like pushes, like squishes her belly.
Oh, no, no, no.
I'm so sorry. And you know what the first thing that came out of my mouth?
Why did you do that?
Why did you do that? And he said, he looked at me in sort of a sad, puzzled way, not even like a defiant way. He's just like, I don't know.
Oh.
And I was like, and to me, so there's a lot of impulsivity that he has. I'm like, he's being really impulsive. And I'm lucky that it wasn't someone who like has a knee-jerk reaction to punch somebody. You know? It's,
yeah. We have to give a shout out to that woman.
Yeah.
Tell her how kind she is.
It was this really sweet Hispanic lady. And she was like, oh, amigo. Oh, my gosh.
Listen, I have some questions, too. So in working, these are questions that come to my website, in working with autism,
mm-hmm.
What advice can you give to parents in dealing with children and adolescents who have trouble following through?
For parents that are working
for
with their
children
kids?
Or adolescents with a high functioning autism, what advice can you give to parents in dealing with children and adolescents when they have trouble following through?
So if the parent has trouble following through or the kid has trouble following
through? No, the child or adolescent has trouble following through.
So, you know, I'm sure you've heard the phrase, if you've met one kid with autism, we've met one kid with autism.
Yes.
And, you know, and even kids who have high functioning autism and similar interests, and they're still, you know, they're as unique as you and I are, you know, it's.
Right.
So.
I agree.
I think especially with autism, you have to really target their interests, and you have to understand how they think, their logic. One of the things I love about working with people with autism, especially high functioning autism, is I refer to them as people who have the most illogical logic. Their thinking is very illogical, but it's all logic based.
Right. Right. No, I understand what you're saying.
You understand it, but like,
yes.
I wonder if like, you know, people who like don't.
They may not, but I get it because of my son. I know what you're saying.
They're very rule based.
Yes. Oh my God. Yes.
So they often have, they do the things they do because they often have rules about that behavior, and it might not always be completely obvious.
Right.
I have a quick story, then come back to the question before I forget it. So I have a client, he's 10-ish, plus or minus in a few years, and he does equestrian therapy, his horse therapy, right? And
okay.
He really likes it, But so this week he didn't want to go to the his horse therapy. He's really giving his mom a hard time. He didn't want to transition, and he still has a hard time with transitioning. He really, really didn't want to go. And his mom was able to finally get him in the car. And on the way there, his mom asked him, "What's going on?" And he said, "Well, I don't want to hurt the horse." Oh. His mom said, "Well, what do you mean you don't want to hurt the horse?" And he said, "Well, I'm getting too big. I'm growing. I don't want to hurt the horse."
Oh.
And we kind of pieced together that probably like there was at some point he heard that he was growing, and then he probably also had heard that like someone was like too big for like either this horse or another animal. Made that connection and thought that he would hurt the horse. And I said to his mom, I'm like, that's great empathy. I mean, he was really thinking about it. And what they did to help him is they had some other people who were clearly bigger than him say, well, they were just on that horse today. And then he was okay. You know, but so that's like that illogical logic.
Yeah, but that's really amazing that he had that kind of empathy for the horse, you know?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It really is, because a lot of times with that autistic spectrum, empathy can be difficult. So
yes, and here's one of the things I found working with people with autism, because you know when I hear that the people with autism don't have empathy, I kind of take issue with that,
right?
Because I think they actually have a lot of empathy. I think sometimes even more empathy. Mm-hmm. I think they have a harder time showing empathy
in an
appropriate way.
Yes. Yeah, they do. They really do.
And I have so many other tangents I want to go on because there's so many interesting things to talk about. I want to talk about micro expressions and reading faces, but I want to answer your question about follow through.
Following through, yeah.
Okay.
That's the question.
So for the child following through, can you give me an example of something?
Okay. So let's say they have homework that they need to complete and they start working on it. They eat dinner, and then they won't finish the rest of it. I'm just using that as an example.
And
so,
it's a good example because it's a common one.
Yeah. So this person is asking, how do you get them to follow through?
Mm-hmm.
What would you do?
Well, if the kid is if he's high functioning, and one of the things that I would I would invite the kids to find out about, like, hey, you know, it seems like you're having a hard time, kind of getting back engaged with homework. And I would just kind of say to him, kind of what's going on, and really try to figure out what he says about that.
Okay.
See if I can get some information about that.
Okay.
But it could be that the school day and doing homework mm-hmm. after school he has nothing left.
Yeah.
I take issue in general with homework. Especially
so do I. I tell the kids I work with, if I ruled the world, there'd be no homework. But I don't rule the world.
Especially through eighth grade. Especially through eighth grade. Because one, there's like very, very little research that supports that homework actually has any benefit. And here's one of the issues that especially for kids with autism, I find that the issue often comes with math homework.
Mm-hmm.
Especially when the kid is good at math. They feel that they are being completely insulted. Why do I have to do this work? And why do I have to show my work? Because I know how to do this. I don't know how to tell you how I know how to do this, but I can get the right answer. And when I'm talking to, you know, I go to IEP meetings and, you know, the teacher said, well, he has to show his work. But he's getting the right answer at a very, very high level. Right.
Right.
I say that what I do is I try to compare, say, okay, so if you enter a social situation, okay, and if you can tell that you've made a social blunder, how do you know? Can you break it down for me? Can you break down the steps for me on how you repair that social situation?
Mm-hmm.
Or if you walk into a party, can you tell me how you know who to talk to first? Can you break those steps down for me? Typically, we just know. We have a sense for it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they, you know, the kids with autism, if it's something that if it's like math and they just look at the problem, they just know the answer, they
That's
get
amazing.
A sense. Like let's focus on stretching their brain and not doing things that are tedious to them. You know, it's they work so hard at keeping it together.
Oh, they do.
You know, I think if they can prove that they know how to do it and three problems are done.
Yeah.
We're done.
No, I agree. I'm behind you 100%. I agree.
Like if they're not doing it right, then they need to do it until they get it right. Absolutely.
I mean, it's so punitive, it makes me sick, but you know.
Right. And so I think that when you're looking at, I think there's homework avoidance and there's the getting back to doing something. Now, one of the things that I think is across the board, I'm sure there'll be an exception here or there, but across the board is, you know, kids do need breaks. Some kids do better by just jumping right into homework or after school.
Right.
Don't have a kid play video games
right
before they do homework. Because, so if we understand executive functioning as this resource pool, and the more we use our executive functions, the less available we have. So let's imagine a kind of a, you have 10 bars of executive functioning if you're a full, right? So you're get through your day, let's say you get home and you have three, you have very little left, right? So you want to play some video games. So you play some video games and that kind of restores you. Now you have four bars, okay, a little bit of a recharge.
Okay.
But now you have to stop your video game and start to do something that you don't want to do. Now you just lost two bars. So you actually have a net loss of one. So video games can be done when everything is done.
Yes. I'm right with you.
Exercise is important. And it's tough. You know, it's like, I love technology, but I have seen in my practice more and more what I would really, truly, clinically define as video game and internet addiction.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. I don't know if you've ever listened to any of my podcasts on Addiction Begins with ADD, but I've had some powerful shows and our dopamine levels are lower than other people just starting out.
Right.
So I tell parents all the time, I mean, I have kids that parents think it's okay for them to be on 7 hours a day. No, that's not, absolutely not going to work. And you have to structure this because they're going to be very addicted.
Well, and I strongly believe that the companies like Apple and I mean all the major companies, they need to be putting things
like
on
cigarettes.
The device.
Yeah, I know. It's
give
addiction.
The tool to allow for self-regulation. I have a program on my computer called Mac Freedom. It's not called Freedom. It works for all the platforms. And what it does is it blocks me from my internet.
Oh,
so
great.
So I can set up a schedule for it to block me from my internet. And the only way around it is to shut off my computer and restart it up. And I typically have like 30 windows open and I don't know where I am at with anything. So it's enough of a barrier so I'm done.
That's a great idea. That's a really good idea.
Many years ago, I bought a Nintendo Wii because I wanted to have it for my office, but I brought it home, you know, for a while just to, cause I wanted to play with it. And I would, you know, here's another lie I would tell myself, just one more game.
Yes, yes.
And so I realized I was doing a really bad job of just one more game because one more game would turn into like 5 hours later. And so what I did is I plugged the Nintendo Wii into a lamp timer. And
great.
I set it for 30 minutes. And when that 30 minutes goes off, that game is up. It shuts off. Because it's usually like that interruption. I'm not going to start it back up. I was probably in the middle of something. So now I'm going to be disappointed and I'm not going to want to start it back up. Right?
Wow. No. Yeah. That's a great idea. And
so
anybody
it's learning little hacks like that.
Yep. Yep. I think that's great.
I think you know, also, before we look at the tools, we have to look at how can we structure our environment to support us.
Yeah, yeah. And structuring the environment is really, really important. It really is, especially for kids and adolescents and adults as well. I mean, we have to structure our environment for ourselves so we're successful too. So, okay, I have another question from somebody. Remembering to pay my bills on time is a huge challenge. Okay. Because here they're saying some are due at different times. What would you suggest? Auto pay is what you're saying.
Auto pay and overdraft protection. And I would suggest if you know the person can get depending on what your expenses are, about $500 that you have in your account that you pretend is not even there.
Right. Yeah.
So it's like that margin of either, you know, it gives you that buffer, that cushion. So you kind of forget about it there. So you don't bounce checks. You have the overdraft protection, you know, have all the alerts that you can for, you know, with online banking. But yeah, auto pay all the way. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. Auto pay is great. I agree. Some people still do it though, manually, you know, they still write checks. They still mail them. They put stamps on the envelopes, you know?
You know, I think the last time I wrote out an envelope and put a stamp on it, it sat on my counter for 4 months and I just threw it away.
I think this person that asked that question is one of those people. So I think they have to come into the 21st century and get online. But I agree.
It depends on what situation this person is in. If it's someone that has a little bit more money, if they can have a bookkeeper that actually does it for them.
Right.
You know, my wife pays all the bills.
I mean, which is great.
Yeah. I mean, it's because I can't. It's, I mean, I can, but everything is going to be on auto pay, and then I'm going to have like a big cushion in my bank account that I don't, like, that I'm forgetting about, right? So it's, I would do it a little bit differently. Yeah, so I think auto pay, absolutely. If for some reason you're like super uncomfortable with auto pay, because if maybe you're going, like, you know, you don't always have the money in the bank, you know, you can get alerts set up when you have money due. And I really like mint.com. All of your financial, everything, you can get information from there. And I can give you notifications. It could also let you know if there's like strange activity going on.
Yes.
But I know some people don't like Mint because of, like, they think that there's privacy concerns. You know, the way I think about it is, you know, with all these credit cards, the fraud protection is so good, is that, you know, as much of an ADHD nightmare as it would be if there was ever, you know, fraud or identity theft, the all of these credit card companies are so heavily backed that you'll be able to recover your money.
Yes. No, absolutely. I do. I agree with you. I do like mint.com. I think it's great. But, you know, everybody, there's other things out there too. If you want to research and look for that. But okay, I have another question. This is interesting. I have to do a lot of creative writing.
Mm-hmm.
So what are your suggestions regarding keeping on task and creating and keeping time limits?
Okay, great question. Great question.
Yeah.
So I hate writing, so it's a funny question too. It's like, it's so painful for me to write. It's why I podcast, because I can talk all day long, but writing is that damn delete button.
Yeah.
So I love the Pomodoro technique.
Okay,
the Pomodoro
I'm familiar
technique
with it.
So it's the idea of monofocus or monotasking. So not multitasking, but monotasking.
Right.
25-minute periods of just one thing. That means you're not checking your email, you're not responding to a Facebook post.
Right.
You're just doing your writing for 25 minutes with a timer. Timer goes off, then you set another timer for 5 minutes, you take a break, right?
Right.
Now that break can be anything from staring at a wall to doing jumping jacks to opening mail. It's just something to shift your brain away from that task, okay?
Right.
So it's not just like veg out, because if you hate opening mail, then you can think, oh, I can do that for 5 minutes, and only 5 minutes. And then the alarm goes off again. And so you want it, the ideal of the Pomodoro method is you do 4 of these in a row, 25 minutes, then a 5-minute break, and then you take a longer break. And
right.
The idea is to try to do as many as you can. And if you really are getting into the Pomodoro technique, you look at your task list, and you actually mark the task items based on how many Pomodoros that task will be.
That's really good. Yeah, I am familiar with that. I love it.
Yeah, everything you have a timer for. Everything.
Yeah. Okay. I'm sure that's a big help for this person, because I'm not into writing.
Yeah. And I would do it in the morning.
Yes.
You know, because that's where your brain is the freshest.
Right.
And I use voice dictation when I'm writing longer stuff. because my brain moves too fast, and even though I'm a fast typer, like I can't keep up with my thoughts, and again, that damn delete button. So I voice dictate.
Yeah, which is great. I mean, I think that's a great idea for people like myself and you. We struggle with writing. I use that too because it's easier for me than to just start typing. Because like yourself, I have too many thoughts in my head going on, especially when it comes to writing. Yeah, not my favorite thing to do. I'd rather
I wrote a song once for the Add a Talent show, and one of the lines was, "I have so many thoughts on my mind all the time. I wish I could just think them, just one at a time."
I like that. That's really great. So, you know, this went by so fast. We only have 5 minutes. So what I really want you to do is, could you tell everybody how they can get in touch with you and, you know, about your Facebook pages, and do you have a website? Can you tell everybody your information?
So best place to go is to ADHDrewired.com. Right there, you can find where you can download the podcast. There's links to I have a Facebook group, I have a Facebook page. The group, you have to request access to the group, and I will interview you before you come in the group. So I do a lot of screening for the group. But ADHDrewired.com is the best place. I'm on Twitter at Eric Tivers. ADHDrewired.com. I'm on iTunes and Stitcher and SoundCloud and everywhere where podcasts are sold. They're all free, by the way.
Yeah. Mine are too. It's the best way to do it. Yeah.
If it's a podcasting joke, I don't know. It wasn't even funny, so I'm sorry I ended on that.
I have to tell you, the last time when you came on and I was on with Tom, that was so funny because I couldn't hear him at the end. And I was like, oh my God.
And I was able to hear you, not hearing him.
And I understand that Tom's on your productivity group, which is great.
Yes, yes. A surprising add to the group, and it's awesome. It's awesome.
Yeah. He's so great. He really is.
And I love his podcast.
Yeah, I love his podcast, and I love him because he just really approaches this with so much humor, and I think we all need to laugh because this isn't a death sentence, and I believe it's truly a gift because we're so creative. And so I just love laughing with him. He's the best. So we'll have him on again soon, too. And love to have you back as well, Eric. And I promise the next time I will announce you with the proper last name.
It's okay. If you don't, I'll forgive you again. So it's okay. And Justine, I want to extend an invitation to you to be a guest on ADHD Rewired.
Oh, I would love that. So we'll talk behind the scenes. I'd love to do that.
Absolutely.
Thanks again. I really appreciate your time and all the great information that you gave to my listening audience. It was great. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Justine.
Have a great day.
Thanks. You too.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And so I want to thank everybody for listening. I know Eric is wonderful. We got a lot of information from him. And we're not going to be back next week, but the week after, we're going to be talking about essential oils, which I think all of us will really enjoy. I've been using them. They work. They're amazing. Okay, so I want everybody to stay in the moment. Have a great day, and we'll see you live in 2.